Okay, well, if no one objects, then we'll use the normal process. If you could just put your hand up using the reactions, you have to go to the reactions button, put your hand up, and okay. Well, we've got a contribution from Darren coming in. Please go ahead, Darren.
Yeah, just a quick question. Thanks for the talk, Paddy. Really very interesting. A lot of information that I didn't know. Don't know about the other people in the meeting. Just one question. You mentioned that Hamas are concerned about the decline in popularity in Gaza in comparison to, say, Islamic Jihad. Do you know where that comes from, the information? Because I don't pretend to know a lot about the region, but I obviously we've been barraged with information or a lot of propaganda since the recent events. And I read that once Hamas won control of Gaza from Fatah in 2006, 2007, there hasn't been an actual election, a proper election in Gaza since, partially because Fatah refuses to like contest elections and Hamas are happy with that situation. You know, what is this measure that they're concerned about jihad? Is this just because Hamas has been getting on with the business of governing the Gaza, and as any ruling party meets with discontent? I mean, I'm just curious where you get that information from. But thanks for the talk. Really, really interesting. And I hope you do go into other details that you said you weren't going to talk about. Thanks.
Well, the popularity of Hamas. I mean, they've been in power in Gaza since 2007, and they've presided over several battles with the Israelis, where the Israelis have come in one for 7 days and one for 14 days, where the Israelis just came in and bombarded them with airstrikes. Meanwhile, there's been a 16-year blockade. By land, sea, and air blockade of Gaza, so it's essentially an open prison. Public services were already on their knees before any of this started. So I would venture to say that the experience of Gazans under the Hamas administration has been probably subjectively worse than it's ever been before. So. I would think that the primary sort of emotion in Gaza was desperation, and I suspect that if Islamic Jihad was saying, well, we need to wage total war, and they were gaining support, Hamas probably felt like it was being outmaneuvered, and if he didn't do something, somebody else would. I don't know, but that's just speculation. It's hard to know. I don't know if that answers the question.
Okay. Well, we've got if unless Darren wants to come back in, I'll take Doogie next.
Hi, Paddy. That was a very interesting talk about all the oil and different things and the gas off Gaza, right? But I mean, I wanted to talk about government's response, Americans' response, Britain's response, the European Union. I mean, they're actually supporting Israel when they're blocking off food, fuel, all the things for life, medicine, and anything, electricity to Gaza. And it's illegal, according to their rules, what they're doing. I mean, they asked some politician from Britain about what happened, and he just said, "We support Israel." And he didn't say we condemn them for doing that. And I was watching a thing by Chomsky, and he was saying the reason Israel's there is because America wanted a policeman in the area. And also, there's Christian Zionism. The Christians that read the Bible, they think, the Jews deserve a homeland in Palestine, and they've supported that, even although, they displaced all the Palestinians or whatever, in 1948. So there's a lot of Christian Zionism, and I think the Germans feel guilty for the Holocaust, and they kind of, support Israel partly as a reaction to that, right? You know, I don't know what you think about government's response and things, and the policemen for America in the area. Anyway, I just wondered what you think of that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did mention about Israel being the U.S. policeman in the area, but only to lead into discussion about the gas situation, because that's changed the role of Israel now. Now it doesn't have to be somebody else's policeman, and I think over the last few years you've seen more and more that Israel has ignored everything that America has said to it. You know, the Obama administration tried to rein it in, was very uncomfortable about this expansionist policy of settlements on the West Bank, tried to get Israel to sort of scale that back, and Israel just basically stuck two fingers up at them. And Israel have been doing that with every US administration. The last US administration that actually managed to bring Israel to heel was George W. Bush that long ago, when he threatened to scale back their sort of funding. So, on the other question, what are the Western governments doing? I mean, yeah, this week we've seen, I mean, in the papers, you've seen an absolute orgy of, you know, of horrified outrage, you know, stories about beheaded babies and stuff.
What again?
Somebody,
for fuck's sake.
You muted.
Somebody needs to mute somebody there.
You mean to?
I'm not.
You just transitioned to make
it. Has somebody? Did you just mute me?
I think I may have done that.
I think you muted me. Yeah. Okay. All right. I don't know what. I don't know what what I was saying when I got muted. I was talking about what Zuggy's question about Western governments, and I was talking about what the papers have been saying, and you'd get this impression that, you know, the whole of the West is just throwing up its hands and saying Israel can do no wrong. But actually, when you look at it a bit closer, you realise that Israel's stock of sympathy credit is already starting to wear thin. Turkey is calling this mass evacuation acceptable. Even Putin, and he would know, calls it quite cruel. The World Health Organization is calling it a death sentence. The Norwegian Refugee Council calls it a war crime. Oxfam has called it utterly inhumane. And here's what the UN said in Geneva yesterday about Gazans. They have lived under unlawful blockade for 16 years and already gone through five major brutal wars, which remain unaccounted for. This amounts to collective punishment. There is no justification for violence that indiscriminately targets innocent civilians, whether by Hamas or Israeli forces. This is absolutely prohibited under international law and amounts to a war crime. So that's the UN's view of what Israel is doing at the moment. So it's not actually true that all governments are backing Israel. But just to check this, I just went on to look at the Labour Party's website and also the Tory Party's website to see what they were saying about it. Because as you can imagine, a lot of the left-wing parties are, you know, plastering this wall to wall on their websites. Not a mention, nothing. Labour Party, not a squeak. Tory Party, not a squeak. They've obviously they're more concerned with each other in the next elections than any of this. It's got nothing to do with them. Keir Starmer was collared on, I think, LBC this morning for saying that he thought Israel had the right to do this. Him, a former human rights lawyer as well. They're probably trying to stay out of it and not say anything that will prejudice them. It's an impossible situation. You can't, if you say anything too sympathetic about the Palestinians, you can be accused of being anti-Semitic. If you say anything about the Israelis, you're accused of being anti-humanitarian. So I think the politic thing for the politicians to do is probably stay out of it. But certainly internationally, I think Israel, what it does over the next couple of days is going to be is going to define Israel, I think, for a generation. If they overreact, which it seems very likely that they will, just like the Americans overreacted over 9/11, they went and invaded a country that had nothing to do with the Twin Towers attacks, and caused 20 years of absolute murder and slaughter. If the Israelis do this, I think it could define, well, redefine global views of the Middle East conflicts.
Okay, can we take Comrade Johnson then, please?
Yes, just a quick correction first, if I may, and that is the use of Palestinian labour. You mentioned the figure of 100,000 Palestinians being allowed to work in Israel. That programme has already started, and the first draft is 20,000, at which they will round it up and put in, put them all in the West Bank there, right? Just a small thing, right? But what I would like to mention is that it seems pretty obvious that the battle map has already been drawn up, you know, with the Israelis turning around and telling what Palestinians who can, right, to get to down to South Gaza, right, and beyond the river that's running right through the Gaza Strip. So it's pretty obvious to me anyway that Israel has no intention of going any further than that river boundary, right? That they only intend taking out Gaza City itself and doing what they can to damage the Hamas infrastructure that's within Gaza City. And most of the Hamas infrastructure is in Gaza City. A lot of it, as you mentioned, is underground, right? They'll try their best to get rid of that. They'll occupy it for as much as they can afford, right, because it'll be a costly business, and they'll be popped off by Hamas stragglers as much as possible. So they'll withdraw from Gaza City when they determine that now, you know, that is necessary. But in the meantime, you know, we can look forward to hundreds, if not possibly thousands, of casualties within Gaza City, you know, which will be deemed collateral damage amongst innocent people, members of the working class, everything. And nothing will be solved within the Middle East as far as this problem is concerned, as long as capitalism exists, you know. How we get over it, is another thing. And the other, well, we can only just try our best, anyway, our damnedest, to make as many socialists as possible. I think that's all. Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Do you want to respond, Paddy, or is that...
No, I don't think that's fine.
Okay. Well, thanks, Brian. Andrew Davis next, please.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Good, all right. Thanks, Paddy. It was head-spinning, actually. Your level of detail and research, I just couldn't keep up with it. I gave up. But I like to take bullet point notes when we have these types of meetings on a Friday evening, but I just couldn't keep up with you. It was so detailed, and it sort of confusing, but also sort of reassuring that we have somebody in the party that is so educated and intelligent on these sorts of matters to be able to present something like that. I just wanted to share with you and you know, I'm going to get criticised for this, but I've got a Facebook account, which I'm sure I'll get criticised for, but I don't have it in my own name. And normally on Facebook, I just use it as something to put on things to keep in touch with old friends and also local arts events and things like that. And it's not under the name of Andy Davis, it's under a different name. But I wrote this, and it's just how I've been feeling about it all week. And I hope that it's not too sort of wishy-washy to sort of say this, but I just wanted to put it out there, really. And I wrote, I get so upset listening or watching the news. It seems hideous and awful all the time. Ordinary working class people in different parts of the world slaughtered by one another in the name of nationalism and or religion for no benefit other than to further enrich the ruling class elites. We have a world in common. The minority of bandits that rule us using the capitalist profit system will be defeated one day by popular will and democracy. Workers of the world, unite. Now, I normally get a lot of responses to my cheeky chappy Facebook posts under my pseudonym, but I've had just two responses to this. One, an old friend who grew up with me, who knows me and my family very well, and the other person, a quite well-known member of the London Irish arts community, who's a staunch supporter of, or was anyway, of the Irish freedom movement, as it was perhaps called at the time. But what I've been very sort of frustrated by, I think, is this idea, you know, within Britain, basically, you know, and it is in within the media about this sort of idea. And it's not just in the media, actually. You've got two things. You've got the media and you've got, you know, what I would call the non-socialist left, you know, the sort of the liberal left, the Labour Party, etc. This idea that they're really, really trying not to, on the left's sort of position, to take any sides in this. And yeah, if you pick up the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Mail or anything else, you know, clearly it's always this very pro-Israel. It just makes me so frustrated, and I think it would do for all of us. But the way that you set your talk out, Paddy, and sort of navigated the whole kind of geopolitical catastrophe that is clearly unfolding, it just really does just beg a belief. And like, you know, I'm a, you know, I hope most of you realize I'm a very committed revolutionary libertarian socialist, but sometimes I just have to switch off and just think about doing some gardening or something. It just does your head in. And that's us in this so-called safe place in the UK. Imagine what it must be like for people over in that part of the world. You know, it's just crazy. So I haven't made a very good point here. It's very personal. But I just wanted to put that out there, really. So thanks for listening to me.
Thanks, Andy. I'm sure everybody shares your opinion on that one. Well, I do. Anyway,
I just want to say a couple of things about that, actually, because I'm really glad that Andy said that, because I think there is a sort of personal, emotional kind of payload, you know, in stories like this that we can't ignore. I can remember, I mean, just, you know, when I first sort of kind of got heavily involved in in politics, I think one of the first moments when I sort of realised that there were no solutions to capitalism, you know, from within capitalism, was in September 1982, 41 years ago, after the Sabra and Shatila massacres in Lebanon, where Lebanese and Palestinian refugees were slaughtered by the Christian militia while the Israeli Defense Force ringed the camps and wouldn't let anyone out. And I can remember feeling that sort of intense that kind of emotional impact then. And it's the same sort of thing now. And what's really difficult, I think, about the sort of view that we've got is that we don't take sides. We can't take sides, because to take sides would betray the entire socialist project. And yet it's so hard when you're empathising with the people suffering from these things, as with the Ukrainians in the situation they're in at the moment. It's so hard to sort of, you know, once you start to empathise, that can turn into taking sides. Really, really easy to do. And it's very, very, I think it's really a kind of, involves certain mental strength by us to keep that sort of level of political objectivity and say there is no solution with this. There is no taking sides in this. However, when you say that everybody's taking the side of Israel, Andy, if you go and look at the SWP site, of course, they're doing the exact opposite. They're completely behind the Palestinians. In fact, they're organising a march in London tomorrow, where they're all going to be waving Palestinian flags in defiance of Suella Braverman, who's just suggested that it might be a criminal offence to wave a Palestinian flag. So they're going to be doing that tomorrow. But I did have a look at one or two of the others. The International Communist Tendency that Robin Cox posted on Splintcom the other day, they've got a really good statement saying a plague on both their houses, as it were, the Israeli ruling class and Hamas. If it wasn't for all the talk about imperialism and the need for a revolutionary vanguard, it could have been written by us. Another party that's produced a pretty good statement is actually the Socialist Party of England and Wales, SPEW. They've got a really good leader article on this where, again, they don't take sides. They say both sides are as bad as each other. And what workers need to do is oppose the violence and organise resistance to both capitalist factions. Unfortunately, they confuse their own message, because in one breath they demand an independent Palestinian state for the liberation of Palestinians, and in the same breath they sort of declare that liberation is impossible anyway under capitalism. So they seem to want to have their cake and eat it. But it's certainly the case that not everyone is taking one side or another. And you mentioned my abundant research, Andy. Well, honestly, if you go and look at YouTube videos, there are some pretty reliable people. You get to know who the reliable ones after a while, people who put the work in and research properly. And if you look at the comments under certain of these YouTube producers, the comments are very much along the lines that you said. They're people who are just sort of despairing about the sort of suffering, but refusing to take sides. There's an awful lot of people out there who are saying, look, this is not what about one side or the other. This is just a terrible situation that people are in. And the most common word that I've seen amongst all these comments is the word heartbreaking, which it certainly is. Okay.
Andy, if you want to come back now. Andy, you're muted.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I was just going to say that Paddy's obviously covered most of what I would have said, but just again, I speak very personally, really. I see this as a massive tragedy for Jewish people everywhere, you know, as well. It's just awful. It is absolutely awful. And, you know, there is a horrendous government in Israel, just like there's obviously this kind of crazy head-banging Hamas kind of outfit, you know, in trying to represent the people living in the Gaza Strip, and you know, and, so on. So it's just awful, heartbreaking, as we've said. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Right, Comrade Buick.
Yeah, I would think that most people, well, in the world, actually, are horrified with what the Israeli state is planning to do. I mean, they've already cut off water and all sorts of supplies to people living in Gaza, and now they're telling over 1 million people, you know, to leave the area. I mean, I haven't heard anybody defending this. Even, you know, listening to the BBC, the journalists there themselves, they're trying to be objective, but I think this isn't sympathy with the Palestine cause. It's just sympathy with what people is going to happen to people living in the in Gaza. I mean it's unbelievable. You wouldn't think that capitalism was, well, you might do, I suppose, capable of you know, such, well, I don't know, such inhumanity, basically. And as I say, I think, you know, well, I think Paddy mentioned this as well, Israel is going to lose what little support it's got in the world anyway. It'll just be left in the end to, you know, Jewish people who are Zionists. But I wanted to say something about Zionism. It was wrong right from the start when it was set up at the turn of the last century. This idea of a homeland for Jews. I mean, you know, socialists and Marxists were arguing, you know, with them, you know, throughout the period, saying, "No, this is not a solution. This, it's, you know, if you're Jewish, you should integrate into the country where you are, and, you know, become part of that people," which in fact most Jews have done. And you've got people like Macron in France and even Zelensky in Ukraine. I mean, that's what they've done. They haven't been Zionists. Anyway, I can see why, after the experiences of the last World War, you know, quite a number of Jews would have been finally convinced that this was the thing to do. And unfortunately, the United Nations agreed to setting up a Jewish state in Palestine. I mean, that was a huge, you know, in my opinion, historic mistake, and it needn't have happened. But it has happened, and there it is. But, you know, one thing which I think will be behind the savagery and ruthlessness of the Zionists, what they're going to do in Gaza, is undermined the whole basic claim of Zionism. It was to establish a safe place for Jews. This was the place where Jews, if they're you know, oppressed in any other country, they can come into Israel and they'll be safe. Well, I mean, this has been, you know, completely blown to bits. You know, 1,000 of 2,000 of their people, you know, slaughtered, you know, by these, in nutcases from, you know, Hamas. You know, so they, in fact, I think the, you know, one reason motivating what the Zionist government is doing is to defend Zionism. It's got to react, you know, to defend its claim that Israel is a safe place for Jewish people if they want to come. It clearly isn't, and it's been shown not to be. And they're not going to take any notice of what the United Nations have said. They've been condemned, you know, many times. I mean, for instance, annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. They just take no notice. They won't get any notice of what the WHO says or the United Nations refugee thing. So it's might is right. Basically, they can they can do it, and they are going to do it. And I'll say that's the situation. And well, to come back to what people are saying, I mean, when I heard this this news that they've given 1 million people 24 hours to get out, I mean, it was unbelievable. But there you are. This is the ruthlessness of it's nationalism, I think, more than capitalism. It's a completely irrational doctrine, and if you fall for it, you can justify anything. The other thing, of course, is the hypocrisy of the Western politicians. Everything that they're denouncing Russia for doing in Ukraine has been done by Israel, and in fact, Russia hasn't done anything like this. Russia's never said to people in Ukraine, "You've got 24 hours to get out of this area." They haven't done it. Well, Israel does it, and nobody publicly condemns them. I imagine, like Paddy said, for various reasons, they'll be putting pressure behind the scenes on Israel not to do this, and maybe. Israel's going to do it anyway, aren't they? I mean, that's the nature of the Zionist ideology.
Sorry, I'm having a bit of a technical problem here. If Paddy didn't want to come back in, I'll take Andrew again. Andrew, please, you're muted.
Hi, Steve. Hi, everybody. Sorry about that. I was trying to close off the room close off the noise from the other room. Just to follow on from Adam's point, I mean, absolutely well made as well. Interestingly, if I understood as well, I think Paddy had looked at the responses of the, what I call the bourgeois political elite parties, the Labour Party and the Conservatives, not like the Daily Telegraph and so on, on the right wing side. In the terms of their response, they're sort of dancing around, trying not to take a side explicitly. Sort of my understandings are that some of this has origins quite close to Britain anyway, because Adam alluded to the role of the UN in working to secure a Jewish homeland. And as I understand it, I don't know a lot about this. I don't know very much at all, but it's just a question really for people that know more than me. But my understandings are that Britain was at least one of the basically the colonial powers in that region. At the time that there was this push towards, creating the State of Israel, and Britain and the West did what it often does when things get a bit sticky. It sort of put on its little pumps and ran away and left them to fight it out for themselves. A recent example of that, obviously, is Afghanistan, and prior to that, in my sort of memory, things like Iran and other places like that. So if anybody is more knowledgeable about that than I am, that would be maybe an interesting line to follow up.
Well, I mean, the British were first involved in Iran in the early 1900s, where oil had been discovered, because their experience of the First World War was, of course, you need a lot of oil to fight a war, and they couldn't rely on American oil, because at the time of the First World War, Woodrow Wilson was the president, and Woodrow Wilson was an isolationist who had no truck with any European empires, including the British Empire. So the British knew that they couldn't rely on American oil, hence their interests in Iran. And they went on to establish protectorates in all of these little oil states that you now see going dotting down the right-hand side of the Gulf. So Bahrain, UAE, Kuwait, all these sort of places, Oman, they were all British protectorates. And so, you know, yeah, the British were absolutely all over that place. As soon as they'd broken up the Ottoman Empire, they carved it up with them, the French. They gave half of Turkey to the French and nearly the rest of it to Italy and Greece, until Turkey then fought a nationalist war under Kemal Atatürk up until 1923 to get most of their mainland back. So, yeah, this is all... yeah, I mean, absolutely, this all comes back to the British, but also the French. Yeah, it's like with all these modern conflicts, you can drill right down and usually find the British at the bottom of it, or one of the colonial powers of the 19th and 20th century.
Okay, thanks, Paddy. Take a contribution from Jane. Question or contribution from you?
Okay, yeah. So a couple of things. I mean, there was the 1919 thing between, I can't remember what the fucking agreement was called, but it was basically Herzl and some of the Zionists went and talked to the British Prime Minister, and he signed an agreement that promised that the Jews would have, or the Zionists, not the same thing, that the Zionists would have a homeland in Palestine. That was the promise. I think it was called the Balfour Agreement, but I'm not at all sure about that. Somebody else will probably know that.
It was, yeah.
The second thing was, at exactly the same time in 1919, the British government was introducing the Aliens Act, which was designed to prevent Jews from Eastern Europe coming to Britain because they were worried about being flooded by the Jews. So it was basically a two-pronged approach of, well, we'll get rid of the Jews here, we won't let them in here, we'll tell them to fuck off to Palestine, and tough shit on the Palestinians, really. And that's kind of basically where it all starts. I mean, it's very, very, all very clear cut. And the British government through the years wavered because the Palestinians were not at all happy with being told that their land was being taken off them. But essentially, that's where it starts. Whether knowing that gets us any further is a whole different question, I'm afraid. And I don't know the answer to that.
Thanks, Tony. That was Tony, by the way. Tony shares a machine with Jane. Did you want to come back on that?
Well, I could actually quote you from the Balfour Declaration. It was 1917.
Okay.
This is what Balfour wrote. Oh, he actually wrote this in 1919. In Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. The four great powers are committed to Zionism, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long tradition, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. In my opinion, that is right. The Labour Party National Executive, I'm quoting from an old Socialist Standard article from 1982, by the way, on Gaza and Palestine. This is the Labour Party in 1944. Palestine surely is a case on human grounds and to promote a stable settlement for a transfer of population. Let the Arabs be encouraged to move out as the Jews move in. So really there was absolute cynicism as far as the, you know, the native inhabitants were concerned. They were to just basically be evicted as far as the great powers were concerned. And, you know, no one gave a shit. No one gave a shit then. And it seems like no one gives a shit now.
If I might just make a comment, just there's nobody else who got a hand up. When I was thinking about this meeting today, I was thinking, where do you say that this stuff, where are the roots of this horror story that we've got these days? And you mentioned that about it goes back further than that, doesn't it? It's I think partly it's to echo what Adam said, I don't think it's not necessarily something that we could lay at capitalism's door, because if we've got this thing about the Balfour Statement, then we've got to wonder, well, why are these people, these Jewish people, trying to get to Britain? Why are they trying to get over here? Because of the way that they were being treated in Eastern Europe. And you know, so it just seems to go back and back. And I was thinking, where do you start unraveling this thing? And I don't think we can really give a definitive answer. Although Paddy's done a fantastic job of giving the modern roots of it, but it seems to go back even further than that. I said to him yesterday in a phone conversation that when they announced this thing about the total siege of Gaza Strip, this is medieval, but it's not even medieval. It goes back before that. It's such a horrible, complicated mess. Hope I've not abused the chair's privilege. Brian, if you don't mind, I'll take Jordan first because he's not spoken yet. Is that okay with you, comrade?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. Well, go ahead then, please, Jordan.
Yeah, what's good, everybody? It's been a minute. Yeah, I was going to say, like, I feel like it is at least indirectly because of capitalism. Like, I would say directly because of Zionism, but Zionism isn't inherently, like, capitalist. There is no such thing as, like, a socialist Zionism. It's, you know, the entire idea of it, like, is based on capitalism, really. Like, so... I know, like, there's going to be a lot of socialists to be like, oh, this is all, you know, all because of capitalism or all because of Zionism. I think they both, like, kind of tie together, at least in this instance.
Well, if I can respond to that and also what Steve said a minute ago about, you know, how far back can you take this? Because you know, the sort of persecution of the Jews goes back centuries. I mean, well before capitalism, well before even modern, you know, society. I mean, there were pogroms in England in the 12th century, even before that. I mean, this, I mean, I suppose you could say this goes all the way back to biblical times. You know, I mean, they were getting the shit kicked out of them by the Romans even. So, you know, historically, the whole problem with the Jews, I mean, it's been well looked at. They weren't allowed to have any land. They weren't allowed to trade. So many of them ended up as moneylenders because it was the only thing they were allowed to do. They weren't allowed to live in the sort of towns and the cities along with everybody else. They had to live in special areas, which became the ghettos. This sort of thing. Again, this is quite difficult because if you take our position, then, you know, we're opposed to states. We're opposed to states as, you know, the coercive capitalist machineries of oppression. But if you take this sort of perspective of Jewish people over hundreds of years of not being allowed to have their own land, not being able to live on anywhere and being shunted from place to place, and then, you know, what happened during the Second World War, you can certainly understand their desire to have their own state with their own state sort of armed forces and stuff like that, so that this wouldn't happen again. But then, you know, you could equally well look at the situation of the Kurds. Now, the Kurds also suffered from this carve-up of the Ottoman Empire by the British and the French. They, you know, they live in one particular area that was divided into four separate states that they then straddled ever since. And they've been sort of massacred by the Iraqi, by the Ba'athists in Iraq. Turkey's going to invade northeast Syria at some point soon, because the Kurds have established a sort of independent administration, which the Turks are not going to stand for. So, you know, they're in a sort of similar situation. And, you know, we can't say, oh, well, the Kurds should have their own homeland, their own state, because it's just not any part of a socialist case to say that. But certainly from the Kurds' point of view, you can certainly see that that would be a step forward for them, because, you know, yes, they would still be workers. Yes, they would be exploited as workers in a capitalist state run by a Kurdish ruling class, a Kurdish capitalist class. But they would have at least removed one extra layer of oppression through being oppressed as Kurds. That wouldn't happen in a Kurdish state. And, Jews in Israel, it's the same sort of situation. But you could apply the same thing perhaps to the Rohingya in Burma, you know, I mean, or the Uyghurs in Xinjiang in northeast China. I mean, there are cases, you could make these cases for so many places around the world. I think perhaps not as bad as, you know, they're not, maybe not all of them are suffering as badly as Palestinians. But where does it end? You know, this is the trouble with capitalist logic. Once you start playing capitalist logic, you lose sight of any sort of socialist kind of project altogether. And that's the ghastly situation we're in. It's so easy to empathise with people, but you can't afford to take sides, because you lose control of the narrative if you do. Have we lost our chairperson again?
My apologies. Brian, if you could come next, speak next, please.
Right. I just had to mention that you asked a rhetorical question earlier on, Steve, and that is, where does this all originate? Well, it all originates to the creation of the Israeli Zionist state. What actually occurred there, it seemed like, you know, there was a takeover between peoples. You know, on the one hand, there was the Palestinians, and on the other hand, there was the Jewish people. In actual fact, you know, typical of capitalism, right, it appears to be the case, but it wasn't. What it was that, on the one hand, you had the Arabs, who were in a fair semi-feudal state, living under a system that was based on land. And then on the other hand, you had an influx of Jewish settlers from Europe, embedded with capitalist ideas and working knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. But especially the technology that capitalism had brought about. And they turned up, they said to the Palestinians, tell them that we're willing to listen anyway. Right, let's get together and let's work this out. You've got the land, we've got the technology, and with both of us going for it, we'll make the desert bloom. But it didn't work out that way. There was disagreement, big disagreement on both sides. Right? But there you have the origins of the conflict. There was a conflict between feudalism and socialism. And unfortunately, that conflict still seemed to be going on, because the Arabs in Palestine haven't changed all that much when it comes to introducing industrial agriculture methods. That's all I'd have to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Interesting point. Comrade Deutsch, please.
Right, thank you. Yes, I was going to join in earlier on this thing about the upset of the news, and my though it's not the main thing that I wanted to say now, but my daughter sent me a text on Saturday saying, sort of ignore the news, though she knew that I would already have seen the horrific news or heard of it, and told me to, you know, enjoy the sunshine and so on, and telling me, you know, to try and forget it. But there was just one little comment I recall from an earlier confrontation, war, whatever you call it, a little Palestinian boy saying to his father, "Are we dead?" as they were running from somewhere. But what I really wanted to say was something about the Palestinians who are actually Israeli citizens and live in Israel. Because when the 400 villages were emptied and destroyed by the army in the 1948 time, about 100 villages survived because they weren't on the main route of the Israeli army, and they were a useful supply of cheap labor in the area. But, you know, Israel is said to be a democracy, but it's only a Jewish democracy, and they didn't actually call the Palestinians they're referred to as Israeli Arabs rather than to Palestinians. And as someone, I can't remember his name at the minute, doesn't matter, said that people that hadn't heard the term Palestinian referred to for a good many years. But you know, there's sort of two teaching systems, and the Palestinian teachers are banned from teaching about the Nakba, and all kinds of things. They can't get more land. They can only sort of build up in the areas where they live. And you just feel that if the answer had been to treat people better, and not, because now they refer to what happened on Saturday and refer to these people as animals, but they always treated them not perhaps as animals, but as not being one of them, as you might say, and a system of that they were not treated as equals in Israel. And the other thing that comment to make is that it's talked about as though it's a battle between equals. And you've got the whole armed might of Israel backed by America and so on. And I'm not making, obviously, any excuses for whatever Hamas did, because that was an unspeakable. But they don't have an army. These are, if you like, militants and behave like terrorists. But then the Israeli treatment of how they deal with it is pretty much like terrorism on a grand style, you know, on a grand
scale.
Scale. Thank you very much. Yes, on a grand scale, where it goes from here, and Paddy, obviously, you know, is much more up to date on the things of all the oil and the things that come into the scene, but it's very hard to deal with. You know, we're obviously, as someone said, sort of safe. It's just sort of you really feel pretty helpless about it. Of what on earth can be done about it? But listening to comments on it is that there has been some more information and background has been given, but so much and really the Labour leader, his comments when he was asked about it, I thought were pretty awful, and I turned him off without hearing what he wants to do for his country. But anyway, I'm rambling on a bit now, comrades, so I'll finish there.
Thanks, Pat. Okay, so we've got Joel now, and go ahead, comrade. Joel, you're muted.
Sorry. I heard a delegate for Israel, for the UN, and some of it, I mean, what he was saying was quite incendiary. He was sort of saying, this is, we have to sort of really destroy the Hamas and change things forever. And it's just like statements like that, this sort of real desire to sort of destroy us, just people. And it's just quite incendiary. And just going back to what Paddy was saying, I mean, that there are other marginalised people in other countries throughout the world that will continue to be oppressed, and those situations are still going on as well while we've got this conflict in the Gaza Strip. Well, if it can be called that, if they destroy it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Joel. Paddy, as we're getting on for time, in a minute, I'll invite you to sum up if you wish. But for now, could I'll take Comrade Bulick.
Just wanted to make two points. One of them is following what Pat has just said. The population of the State of Israel is only about 80% Jewish. And in fact, a lot of them have come from Arab countries, and what they were Arabic speaking people of the Jewish religion. So even them can be called, you know, it might sound like a contradiction in terms, but they were Jewish Arabs. And also the whole of the population of Palestine are not Palestinians, what people call it, but they're not all Muslims. You know, some of them are Christians of one definition or another, and there are also other minority groups living in Israel. I mean, there's the Druze, and I mean they're allowed to serve in the Israeli army or the Israeli police force. Similarly, the Bedouin Arabs who happen to be in Israel are also allowed to serve in the Israeli armed forces. So you know, it's not a question of Arabs all being Muslim, and it's a religious thing. But the other point I wanted to make was that not all Jews are Zionists or historically have been. I mean Karl Marx himself, the first pamphlet or article he wrote. Well, virtually the first article after becoming a socialist was called The Jewish Question, and his argument there was that people should seek, he wasn't entirely into the working class line, people should seek emancipation as human beings. People should, you know, what should happen is Christians should stop being Christians and Jews should stop being Jews, and they should all regard each other as secular human beings. And there's a whole socialist tradition. I mean, Rosa Luxemburg, and also, you know, many members of our own party who would be regarded as a Jewish. So, I mean, there's always been, even within people who are regarded as Jewish, there's been opposition to, you know, to Zionism, and we should be on their side, not on the, you know, obviously nobody here is on the side of the Zionists. I don't think anybody in the world is, in fact, except for the Zionists themselves. I just wanted to make that point that not all Jewish people, even today, are Zionists. I mean, if they were, they would be living in Israel, but they choose to live in the countries where they were born and brought up.
Okay, thank you. Right, well, comrades, as it's 9:10, Paddy's done a sterling job for us, I think, tonight, by the way. I'll just invite him, if he wishes, to do a bit of summing up.
Well, I just, there was one thing, I can't really, I think we've said, we all know how we feel about this. I think we're united in a sense of sort of socialist impotence at the moment, just because this is not our agenda. This is why we can't take sides, because this is a capitalist war, as we know. So it's just we just have to sort of mutely watch the suffering and watch it play out and watch, you know, both sides just go to horrific excess. One thing I did notice, just going back, I was going to mention about how other groups were reacting to this, and something I noticed that you might have seen was a report that the EU is clamping down on social media over this because of supposed disinformation or misinformation, and there certainly has been some misinformation, people posting videos that didn't, you know, that were years old and things like that, but the EU is clamping down. They've got a new law, they just passed it 2 months ago in August. It's called the Digital Services Act, and under this act they can call all the social media giants to account. So that's X, formerly Twitter, TikTok, Meta, which runs Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram, and basically have them on the red carpet about what content they've got. And so far, it seems that the social media companies are complying and pulling loads of accounts. Now, some of these accounts will be very likely be disinformation accounts. Let's not have any illusions. But it makes you wonder about the information war of the future, when a big political bloc like the EU can call social media giants to account and tell them basically what content they can and can't have. I think that the EU law is probably well intended by and large. There is a problem with misinformation and disinformation, which is a different thing, on social media. We've seen sort of, you know, conspiracy theories spread like wildfire because of social media and things like that. So it is a big problem. But I think also there is a question of, in future conflicts, you know, the role of free media is sort of under question. Where I got a lot of my information was from what would be classed as social media sources, because you just wouldn't see them in the mainstream press. What Western press is saying, what the British press is saying, is in most cases there's an agenda there. There's a political bias, which you can only get round if you go to social media and, you know, you go to trusted sources, not dodgy sources or my mate on Facebook says that sort of things. But, yeah, I think there's something there to be, to keep an eye on in the future, the sort of state's attempted control of social media is something to think about for the future. But as for the rest of this, well, we've just got to grit our teeth and hope that the Israelis just hold back and don't do the terrible things they're threatening to do, and that this doesn't turn out to be as ghastly as we're all fearing it's going to be. And that's all I can say about it.
Okay, thanks very much, Paddy. We've got a meeting next week. Adam, have we got a title for that meeting?
Yeah, it's going to discuss whether ethical investment is possible.